Good morning and welcome to the January 13th, 2025 edition of Mountain Money. It's a chilly morning here in Park City, so stay tuned. We've got a really interesting show coming up. We're going to start by speaking with Steve Davis of Zions Insurance. We're going to be talking about the homeowners insurance implications of the disastrous wildfires currently burning in the Los Angeles area.
And then we'll finish up the hour with Stephen Curry and Rudy Layfelt-Ellinger of Proverbial Spirits, and they'll share their experiences of starting a spirits company in Utah and some of their offerings.
That might be just the thing to hear about after we hear about the wildfires, turning into hearing exactly. about spirits. And we'll also get their perspective on that latest guidance about only having less than one drink a day.
With the Canadians.
All this and more on Mountain Money. Stay tuned. The leading national news story over the last week has been the extraordinary wildfire situation in Los Angeles. While the personal impact of the fires is incalculable, this morning we're going to focus a bit on the economics. What will this disaster mean for people seeking to insure their homes in California in the future? What does it mean for those whose homes have been damaged or destroyed? And what kinds of impact can we expect this latest disaster to have on the insurance market here in the Wasatch Back? We're joined this morning by Steve Davis, who's been on this program before. We're glad to welcome him back. He's the Senior Vice President of Zions Insurance. He's going to help us figure all this out. Good morning, Steve. Thanks for coming back.
Hey, thanks for having me back on the show.
Steve, let's start with perspective. Can you put the current wildfire disaster into some historical context?
Well, from the news reports, we can see that you've seen the terms used like Armageddon and insurance time bomb that has just gone off for many insurers, and obviously the catastrophic loss of property and life. It's just been unprecedented.
Yeah.
And again, when we think about, when you say unprecedented, we've seen other disasters. We've seen Lahaina, we've seen hurricanes. Again, do we think that the magnitude of the loss here is going to be significantly different than anything we've seen before?
Well, that's what we're being told is, we're estimating potentially up to $20 billion in property and casualty losses. And I feel that that number is likely low because there's also the uninsured factor that can go into that, as well as many of the unknowns. And in addition to that, if this fire continues, it's just going to continue to get worse and worse.
So let's get a little more perspective. Tell us a little bit about the homeowners insurance situation in California. This is all happening against a backdrop of a changing insurance market as a result of wildfire risk. Can you explain a little bit about what's been going on in California prior to this and how it's likely to change?
Well, over the last several years, what we've been seeing in California is a lot of insurers have recognized the risk of the brush and the dry conditions. So many insurers have been non-renewing policies, some of the big ones such as State Farm, Farmers, Allstate, and many others. And what they're recognizing is the amount of risk that they have in these areas, and that's caused them to really give pause in terms of what the exposure is to them as a company, because in the end, these insurance companies, they want to make money and they want to be profitable. So as an executive making a decision for the insurance companies, you know, they've had to make the hard decisions of non-renewals. So you've seen a lot of homes that have been non-renewed throughout many parts of California. And in fact, just recently, State Farm non-renewed about a year ago over 30,000 homes. And after doing some research, I discovered that about 69% of these homes are in the Palisades fire area.
So State Farm is kind of won on that one by getting out of it.
Well, at this point, when you look at the reasons why they non-renewed their policies, it was lack of the community to go and do the fire mitigation that was necessary to be done. And so they really had no other choice.
Yeah, so now when you say lack of the community to do that, is that up to the municipality or a homeowners association or individual homeowners, would you say?
It's my understanding that the municipality had allocated the money, but the work was never completed. And so it became a discussion between the State Insurance Commission and State Farm, and they said, look, if the work's not been done, we're going to have to exit and get off of these homes.
Gotcha.
I want to say we're going to come back to things that, you know, sort of mitigation strategies later in this interview. But I just want to sort of touch on, so people have a better understanding of the complex relationship between the insurers and the backup plan. I understand that California has something called FAIR for people who can't be insured. Can you explain a little bit about that and how that interplays with private insurers as this disaster, you know, sort of resolves itself?
Well, the California FAIR plan is used as a coverage for homeowners of last resort. So if your insurance has been canceled and you've not been able to find a replacement policy, then as a last resort, you can go to the California FAIR plan. When the plan was initially introduced, though, it was only intended to insure a small minority of homes that had gotten put into that situation. And according to some numbers that I was looking at, the amount of exposure that the California FAIR plan has grown incredibly large. In fact, you're talking over $400 billion in exposure that this FAIR plan now holds, depending on some of the articles that I read. And the other concerning issue is the FAIR plan does not hold enough in reserves to pay out those large type of claims that can happen when you have these massive fires happen. And I believe that this could be a triggering event where it could completely exhaust the reserves of the FAIR plan.
Oof. So let's jump from California to here in the Wasatch back. How has the wildfire risk there affected the market here in the Wasatch back? And does that work that way?
Well, I believe there is a domino effect. And as I meet with various insurance company representatives, we do see that experiences that they are having in states like California, Colorado, primarily, are having an impact on decisions being made here in Utah. So since March of 22, we've seen a dramatic shift in the way that the insurance carriers actually underwrite their policies or make decisions as to whether or not they'll insure a home. And so it's been, from my perspective, very incredibly difficult as an agent, as well as many of the community members have likely seen their premiums skyrocket tremendously. Also, many individuals have had their home insurance canceled, and mm-hmm. that leaves them in a very difficult position because in the current market, there's only a few companies offering coverage. So if you've been canceled, it becomes very difficult to find a replacement policy.
And there's two reasons for cancellation. One, the insurer doesn't want to insure that particular home, and the other is because an insurance company just pulls out of the area.
Well, currently, I'm not aware of carriers that have exited, like the state of Utah, for example.
Okay.
But one of the major companies that we work with, Chubb Insurance, they actually have a moratorium, and they've had it in place for about the last year and a half, where they're not writing any new business in the Park City area and the Wasatch back.
Are they continuing the policies they have, or are they starting to slowly cancel those as well?
They did an evaluation. So insurance carriers, they look at what risk they have in certain areas and where they have high concentrations of risk. Mm-hmm. They'll go in and they'll non-renew homes that have these high where they might be in a high wildfire zone. So they don't want to have like too many homes in a certain area, in a certain geographical area, because if there were a fire, you know, they could be out a lot if they're insuring, you know, 10 out of 20 homes in the neighborhood.
Yeah.
That's not good for an insurance company. So for insurance company and for our market to be healthy, it's actually better that we have a lot of participating insurers because it really helps to diversify the risk amongst many different insurers. And so we're really on the verge of getting into a very precarious situation in the Wasatch Back, where a lot of carriers have stopped offering coverage for a lot of homeowners, and we're down to very few who will still offer coverage.
Yeah. And now, historically, as I understand it, this just didn't used to be a big deal. You would reach out here in the Wasatch Back, I'm buying a house, I need home insurance, you get a quote, maybe you get two or three. Now, I take it, Steve, from our conversation in the past, that the way underwriters are looking at it is more nuanced and sophisticated. How do, you know, it's not just the distance from the fire station, which I think is what it, didn't that used to be the key criteria?
Yeah, I mean, I've been writing in Park City, writing homeowners insurance in Park City for close to 30 years. And up until a few years ago, we would look at a home, we would go in and quote, you know, the home. And generally speaking, we could have an approval within the same day. Never any real issues. Distance to the fire station that most insurance companies use as their guideline is about 5 miles. So as long as you're within about 5 miles from a local fire station and you have a fire hydrant, then most insurance companies, you know, barring any other underwriting concerns, are going to, you know, step up and offer coverage. And for the most part, homeowners also didn't have to do anything. Mm-hmm. You know, you just get a quote, you get your policy, and you're good. And so what's changed since then is in March of 2022, again, this is some of what was happening in California. They introduced what's called a wildfire mapping. Wildfire mapping is something that's being done by in insurance companies that hire third-party vendors to basically look at the wildfire risk for each individual home. So now, instead of just looking at like a fire hydrant, a fire station within 5 miles, now the biggest hurdle we have to cross is the wildfire mapping. So the mapping can typically, depending on the carrier that's doing the mapping, they'll typically score the home. One particular company might use a scale of 1 to 50, where 50 might be the very highest wildfire risk, and other companies might use a scale of 1 to 100. But nonetheless, they're looking at the topography. They're looking at, you know, where the home is located. They're looking at a variety of different factors that essentially boil down to the risk of wildfire to that one particular home. And what's interesting is you could have one home that gets declined because of the wildfire mapping, and you could have another home several blocks away that is fine. It maps out okay. So the struggle that we have is that's now the first hurdle, and it supersedes the fire hydrant and fire station. So now a lot of people, like in Toohey and other areas, you know, they're in desperate need of, you know, getting a fire hydrant, you know, closer to the area. But that in and of itself is not going to solve the dilemma, because a lot of the carriers are using the wildfire mapping, and that is now superseding everything else.
And how many different companies are doing this wildfire mapping? Like, if I'm State Farm, I can use this guy over here or use that crew over there. I mean, is there one company doing it?
No.
Okay.
I started researching this back several years ago. And so initially I thought, well, there's one company. So I spoke to the CEO of that company. But after doing some research, there's dozens of companies. And so my initial thought was, well, what can we do as a community to coordinate with the wildfire mapping companies to basically identify, okay, what areas within our community score high? And how can we as a community work to lower those scores? And so that's become a very challenging issue, because now there's literally maybe a couple of dozen companies that I'm aware of, mm-hmm, that are doing these mapping of our community. So it's something that I think we need to be cognizant of. I think it's something that we need to get our hands around. both as an insurance agent, as a community, in learning how the market is assessing us. And it's something that there's really, to my knowledge, no communication between the community or, you know, the city council and the insurance carriers. The insurance carriers are just solely making these decisions based upon their perceived risk.
I want to, you know, get back to what we can do as a community, but I first want to sort of touch on, I think people would be interested in, what happens if I can't find one of these? There are only a few major carriers now that are writing homeowners policies. I take it here in Summit County. What happens if I can't get a policy from one of these people? How do I get my house insured?
Well, when I was on your show before, I made a prediction that there was a runaway freight train coming to our community, and it has hit in a big way. And so so most homeowners have what's called an admitted home insurance policy through their respective carrier. And what that means is essentially that that insurance company has been registered with the state of Utah to be able to do business in our state. They file their rates. The rates cannot deviate from one customer to another. They have to charge the same rates for everybody. So what's now happening is a lot of these carriers have now introduced a new product. And that product is what's known as an excess and surplus lines policy. So it differs from the admitted policy from the standpoint that it is regulated outside of the state of Utah, and the insurance carrier, instead of being regulated on what rate it can charge, they can charge the rate for the risk. So that means if they have a home in a very high wildfire area, they can do things like add a wildfire deductible of 10%. So if you have $1 million home, you might have $100,000 deductible. If you have a $10 million home, you have $1 million deductible. So we're also seeing some carriers that will exclude wildfire altogether as a covered peril. So that's what's happening currently. So I don't believe we've gotten to a point as what's happened in California where the state of Utah does not have a fair plan. There's no Utah fair plan. So to my knowledge, most individuals, with some very few exceptions, are still able to get coverage, but you're having to search far and wide. And it's no longer something where we're getting approval in one day. It may take us a couple of weeks in some cases to get approval, because we're having to basically go back to the underwriters of the respective carriers and basically negotiate the ability to get insurance for that client. And so when the lights turned on for these excess and surplus lines policies came on, the underwriting companies have all just been inundated with applications. And so it does take a significant amount of time to get those types of quotes. But what I'd like to point out to your listeners, that if you end up with that type of a policy, you can expect a premium of about $8,000 per million. So that means that if you have a $10 million home, your premium could be $80,000 per year.
And if we think about the vast number of homes in Greater Summit County, or at least certainly on the Snyderville Basin side of Summit County, a lot of those homes are over $3 million. So you're looking at a $24,000 a year insurance?
That's correct. And so in fact, I was just having a conversation the other day with a client of mine in Promontory, and they made the comment, Steve, we were just paying $2,500 for our, $2 million home here not too long ago, and now our premium is $10,000. What's happened? And so one of the other things I'd like to point out is the insurance carriers have also utilized these wildfire scoring as part of their rate generation.
I'm sure.
So we're seeing the premiums in the Wasatch Back increase significantly due to the wildfire score of your home.
I want to get to sort of proactive steps that you would recommend people take, but I just said, as I'm listening to this, I'm wondering, are you starting to see people putting insurability contingencies in real estate purchase contracts? In other words, if I'm buying a house, I want to make sure I can get it insured before I'm having to close. Are you starting to see that at all?
I think in most instances, people buying homes, I think the real estate market, you put down your earnest money. Mm-hmm. I would hope that any realtors listening are putting that into their contracts, because some of the homes, especially in the areas that are in the trees, which is a lot of Park City, you need to make your clients aware that could be a potential deal breaker if your client's not able to, number one, find insurance, number two, I don't know how happy the client will be if they're having to pay, you know, $40,000, $50,000, $60,000 a year for their home insurance.
Yeah, and that almost works, because if they don't have that contingency, then they can't get a mortgage, and then the whole thing would fall through anyways, I imagine.
Steve, we've talked, and I know you do some work with homeowners insurance, with homeowners associations. What are some of the kinds of things that you're seeing people who are trying to be proactive about this, trying to manage the risk, trying to help their communities get reasonable insurance? What are some of the things you see people are doing, and what would you recommend they do?
Well, I've been working on, as a consultant for a wildfire board for a large HOA here in Park City. And I initially started, you know, working with them just on a voluntary basis. And in the beginning, where I started was calling the insurance providers to see, you know, what were their concerns? What was holding them back? And so ultimately, it boiled down to three major components. Number one, defensible space and home hardening. So if you want to really work to protect your home, that's the best place to start, whether you're in an HOA or an individual homeowner. So one of the things that we highly recommend is, if you have any trees around your home, you know, you don't want any branches within 10 feet of your roof line. You don't want any combustible materials within 5 feet of the foundation of your home. So a lot of homeowners we see have the mulch around their house or any other combustible materials or plants. You really want to work to have those removed from your home. And then the second thing that you want to do is expand your defensible space utilizing the FireWise guidelines. So most importantly, you're going to trim your trees. You actually want to cut the branches of your pine trees up about 6 to 8 feet off the ground. And you want to clear out any dead trees that have fallen. You want to clear any branches. You want to clear any dead leaves. You really want to get that out of the perimeter of your home out to 100 feet.
Wow.
And by doing that, it really will help to give you protection of your home in the event of a fire. So that's component number one. Component number two is essentially we have a lot of common area in HOAs where the common areas are not being mitigated, or in this case, we're working to mitigate the common area in the HOA. And so in this HOA that I'm working with, we're working to bring the common area to a FireWise standpoint, which what you're looking at essentially is taking out all the dead trees, clearing out taking out some trees so you have a wider spacing of trees between the canopy. And by doing that work, it really can help to, again, further protect the community. And then the third step is fire apparatus. So in some cases, although you have the Park City Fire or Summit County Fire. In many cases, the insurance companies are concerned with private communities because there's only one access point to the community. And as we've seen in California, as people were exiting the community, they were basically having to leave their cars in the middle of the road. And so what that did was obstruct the fire trucks that were attempting to come up the road. In some cases, you'd see bulldozers like pushing those cars out of the way. So in talking to insurance providers, what they would like to see is more fire apparatus. If it's in a mountain HOA, they'd like to see the fire apparatus actually up on the mountain. They'd like to see full-time fire personnel up manning those stations, especially during the summer months, and then during the winter months for structural fires. So that's a real concern, because if you think of a lot of our communities that are in HOAs, they have limited entry and exit points because they're gated private communities. Mm-hmm. But for individual homeowners, it's all a question of really determining a way that we can work with the municipality, work with the state and federal fire groups to make sure that we're properly clearing out our trees and creating a healthy forest by making sure that they're more resistant to heavy wildfires.
Steve, I'm going to bollocks the term. You've made a reference to wildfire guidelines or wildfires, safe wildfire.
Firewise?
Firewise?
Firewise.
Where could people find that if they wanted to look at it themselves?
You can just Google the term Firewise. Okay. It's actually the national guideline. Mm-hmm. So typically what that guideline does is it gives you recommendations that you can do to help harden your home. And so generally it's broken down into four stages. So stage one is a distance of about 30 feet out from your home. Stage two is like 30 to 50 feet. And stage three and four goes out to a full 100 feet.
Yeah, that's taking out my neighbor's house at that point. And it is firewise.org, just so our listeners have that. Please go there and find out what you can do, because this is not a maybe. This is when?
You should be doing this now.
Yeah.
And it does two things. Is it can, number one, protect your family and protect your home, but also as a community, it's important that everyone participate, because as these fires come through for homes that are not in compliance, they stand a higher probability of catching on fire if they have not done the work. And so I continue to, you know, wage the battle within our community and trying to think of ways to be creative and to try to coordinate with community members to be aware. And I really want to work to bring the insurance carriers to the table with our city councils and firefighting crews. And really have a round table. I think that would really benefit so that everybody's cognizant of, hey, why are insurance companies making these decisions to our community members, and how can we improve that?
Yeah.
We've been speaking to Steve Davis of Zions Insurance about the impact of the wildfires in California on us here in the Wasatch Back and things we can do. Steve, thanks for spending time with us this morning.
You're welcome.
Just when you thought it was safe to go back in the liquor store, Proverbial Spirits enters the market. They're distillers of vodka, gin, and rum, all with names taken from known proverbs. They're also making canned sparkling alcoholic beverages, and all their products are made from locally sourced ingredients. Joining us this morning are co-owners, co-founders, distilling masters, Stephen Curry and Rudy Layfelt-Ellinger. Good morning, guys. Welcome to Mountain Money.
Thanks for having us.
So let's drop the puck here. What led you to go into this business?
I've always been a home brewer, so this is the next step in that process.
And COVID was a convenient time to hang out in the basement and practice these kind of things. So we decided to take it legit and legal and open in Park City 3 years ago.
Did you have any sort of, is your professional career, have any relationship to alcohol prior to this?
No, just professional of drinking alcohol, consuming it. Both of us, we both brewed, and just it is the evolution. And I actually had some friends that worked for some other distilleries around here, so I was able to pick their brain, too, to help learn that. But we both work in a very different career than alcohol.
So, what's interesting here is, like, I would imagine this is a rather dramatic career shift. Did it take a lot of introspection and, you know, like, to take this on? As a business, it looks challenging to me.
I think we just decided to wing it. We didn't put a single thought into it.
No complex business school, business plans, and multiple iterations, and and financing, and all that kind of thing.
Just practice.
We probably should have, but we didn't. We both come from the film industry, so it's a lot of problem solving, short-term problem solving, and that's kind of how we've been treating this: is just pick a day, pick a problem, and just figure out how to get that one done, move on to the next problem,
and tackle it at that time.
Yep.
Now, I bet a lot of the tackling was dealing with the ATF for labels, bottle sizes, dealing with the state of Utah for anything liquor related. What was the biggest challenge with either of those?
The federal government's been pretty easy as long as you know how to do the paperwork properly. It goes pretty smoothly. The state of Utah has a new CEO. And she's, Tiffany has been great promoting local businesses. They started a Utah Proud program. So liquor stores are featuring local products, which they've never done before. So it can't, as long as you learn how to dot your I's and cross your T's with the state, things go smoothly. And they're changing and they're progressing, understanding that it's a billion-dollar industry for the state of Utah.
Yeah. So you're distilling here in Park City?
Everything is done. We don't just carry the local tag. We do everything locally. We source local products. We use, in our vodka, which is the base for our gin, we use Utah corn from Solstice Malts. We use mountain malt for our rye. And in our canned cocktails, we're using a honey that we're sourcing locally from Park West Honey, and they are using hives in northern Utah, so we don't just live the local name tag. We actually stand behind it.
Nice. And how long is the distillation process? So you start with the vodka, you said?
Yeah, so the vodka would be we mash the grain, so the corn and the rye go into it are heated up, just like the beer process. It's a three-day ferment, and then a stripping run, which is a day, and then a vodka run, which is another day. So we could do get vodka in 5 days. Mm-hmm. Gin would be a sixth day. You do one more distillation and add your botanicals.
And what about rum?
Rum is longer fermentation. It ferments for about 9 to 10 days, and then it just will do a single distillation because you really want to keep all those flavors in the rum. And so we run it quite a bit faster, where the vodka run could be a 12 to 18 hour run to really run it slow and clean up, you know, make it as pure as you can. The rum, you want to keep as much flavor in it as you you worked hard to get those flavors, so you want to keep them. And so you run that quite a bit faster and hotter, and so you can have rum in 2 weeks.
Gotcha.
And then now we're barrel aging rum, so that's aged for 7 years before we got it, and then we've put it an additional year on dessert wine barrels.
Nice.
That one takes a little longer.
Yeah, I'll bet. I bet it tastes pretty good.
So I'm visualizing a legal version of Walter White's sort of meth manufacturing laboratory. I'm just trying to figure out how much equipment does this take and how large is the facility?
We like to joke that we're the world's smallest distillery, and if somebody wants to challenge that claim, let's go. We have 390 square feet plus whatever we can capture of the parking lot that day. And steal as much as we can. That's kind of one of our biggest challenges in Park City. It's like commercial real estate is so expensive, and finding available real estate, industrial real estate, is so hard that growing has been a real challenge for square footage, because you have a couple hundred gallon tanks in there and maybe a pallet of grain and a pallet of cans. Suddenly you're very cozy.
And are you doing one product at a time? I mean, given that size constraint, I'm struggling to see.
We generally are. So we're batching. We're batching. We're making a vodka, and then we'll decide if we make that vodka into gin or we keep it a vodka. And then same for rum. The rum and trying to a little bit of on time delivery for like making sure we just have it. Not sitting on it because
you don't have room for that either.
We don't have room for that either. And then you know we've been focusing on our cans right now, and so the can space takes up a lot more than you would ever expect.
I want to get to cans, but I want to go back a minute because I mean you now have this variety of products. You had to start somewhere. Tell us about your first product and how you sort of developed it and how you first were able to find a way to take it to market.
So our first product was the gin. We were all gin drinkers and wanted to elevate the gin and create a real, I hate to use the word craft because it's kind of bastardized, but a small batch gin that's not your dad's London Dry. Lots of great flavors come through citrus and coriander and juniper and everything. and so that was our first product, and we added the rum after that. And so the gin process, we did a lot of bench testing to see what botanicals we wanted to add in.
I was going
to
ask you about that.
So we started with just a simple maceration, mm-hmm. and we took multiple combinations of botanicals and sort of narrowed it down to what kind of things. Like I think we tried anise at one point, and everybody just was like, no, anise is not in this gin. And it's in other people's gins, so it's really a taste thing. So,
I'm getting a Willy Wonka vision. Okay,
yeah. I think that's more accurate than Walter White. I'd like to think at least.
Okay, so, and of course, Kevin and I would have been glad to volunteer to help you taste. We're really disappointed you didn't think of it.
Spirit development and cocktail development are probably the hardest part of the job.
But staying with that. So you do a small batch. I mean, I'm hearing you say I've got to experiment with these different ingredients, like anise.
Yeah.
So you do a small batch. You try adding. Tell us some of the other things that you. First of all, what's in the current gin that you like, and then you know what are some of the things that you tried and eliminated other than anise.
So to be called gin, 75% of the botanicals are juniper.
Okay.
So
that's
always going to be the first thing you smell.
You taste. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. We use juniper. We use coriander, which is kind of an earthy taste, mm-hmm. cardamom, which is a little spice, angelica root, which doesn't add a lot of flavor but is an emulsifier. It helps those other flavors stabilize, and blood orange, which is our signature sort of citrus, and then a little black pepper on the end.
Mm-hmm.
So we use like 7 pounds of juniper, depending on the size of the run,
right,
and 12 peppercorns. So it's
the scale really matters of what you're doing. Like you put in, you double the peppercorn, it's gonna, even though it's such a small volume overall, it really changes, and you instantly know it. You're like, oh, that was not right.
Now I remember hearing stuff about triple distilled vodka some years ago. One of those European companies.
TTB clarified that a couple years ago. They used to count every plate in a still as a distillation, and there is an argument to support that. Now they are considering it every run through a still, so every entire process. I think they changed that 4 or 5 years ago, because that's how you were hearing like these 21 times distilled. Well, they didn't run it through the still 21 times. They have 21 plates in their still, which does, adding more plates to your still does clarify it better, but vodka by law has to be distilled spirit with a cumulative proof over 92%. So pretty much all vodka is getting to a similar point in clarity just by its legal requirements.
So 92% alcohol, so you have to dilute it down to make
and
it?
Then, yeah, and then we add a water back to it.
Mountain water.
Of course,
And for those who have forgotten high school chemistry, can you explain what the term distill actually means in this context?
Yeah, so all we're doing is when we distill, we're adding a bunch of liquid to a pot, same as you would on your stove, and we're taking the steam that comes off, and different liquids boil at different temperatures. And so we're taking the alcohol, which distills at a lower temperature than water, mm-hmm. and we're bringing it up through the column, cleaning it up by doing multiple times. It helps separate out and clear your fractions. And we're keeping the good stuff and getting rid of the bad stuff.
Can you reuse the bad stuff?
You can squeeze more out of the bad stuff, but you can't reuse the bad stuff. Like, gotcha. Your heads and your tails are always going to be your heads and your tails. Now, those cuts, they get a little bit of smearing in them when you're cutting. Mm-hmm. And so you can add those back in. They help you still run a little better on your warm-ups. But you're never going to convert those, right? They are the compounds that they are. You can get a little bit cleaner of cuts out of them, but you're never going to get rid of that stuff. It's no good.
Is the process one that's so consistent? I mean, do you have sort of differences in batches that you have to address? Do you ever get a batch that just didn't work for some reason and have to figure out why?
That's definitely a hard part when you're playing chemistry that you never went to school to be a chemist, is consistency. And that's a huge, that was the hardest part, or is the hardest part we're learning, is being, because we are we're quite small batch, mm-hmm. being the smallest distillery in the world. It's not High West doing 2,500 gallons at a time.
Right.
We're doing 150, and so we have to do multiple and combine them together. That benefits us a little bit where we're blending them together, so we help gain our consistency there. The other thing, just the more you do it, the more you write down what you're doing, and the more consistent you get with it, the easier it goes, and you get more consistent. Because definitely early on in testing in small stills, like when we were still in the basement, staying consistent was hard.
I mean, did you go from like 8 peppercorns and go, need more, try another batch with 9, and then finally got to the 12? Oh, 13, yeah.
It was something similar to that. I don't remember how many test batches we did, but I would guess it was over 80.
Wow.
To come up with that. What do you think?
Yeah, it was a small 16-gallon still that yielded a bottle of gin. So small scale.
Wow, that's a lot of work.
Yeah, and so the big leap was going from a 16-gallon still to a 150-gallon still, and hoping that recipe made the leap with us. And there were some minor adjustments, but in the small batches, we got the core recipe down first before.
So you guys were cranking this out for a couple of years without making a dime, just doing all the research.
Yeah, basically. Yeah,
correct, yep.
And now it's time to cash in on all that hard work. Appropriately.
That's the plan.
That's the goal.
Let's talk about that. You know, a lot of times we'll have entrepreneurs in here. We'll talk about the development of product, the marketing of a product, the advertising of a product, all those kinds of things. This is kind of a unique kind of a deal because, obviously, as I understand it, the only people you can sell through is the Utah State Liquor Store Network. How do you promote a product given those kinds of constraints?
So, marketing in the state of Utah is difficult. If you have ever walked into the liquor stores here, there's not a single banner or point of purchase display or nothing. They are slowly moving into that, and we will be able to brand in the stores. But it's, we're basically, it's social media and events. We do a lot of events. So we go out, we're going to go meet each customer in person, one by one. So we do something like the Park City Wine Festival. Two years ago, we served 400 painkillers in a two sessions. So,
what's a painkiller?
Painkiller is our loose lip sink ship rum,
okay.
Pineapple, orange juice, and coconut cream. And if you're a sailor, you've run into this drink at the Soggy Dollar bar.
You've run into 20 of them.
So it's great because we do get to meet people face to face, and they have questions about our product. And it is a great. It's a slow way to market, but it's
maybe the only way to market.
We enjoy it. Yeah.
Yeah.
And social media. We've been working with paid social media and found a lot of success there. But your sort of typical avenues that you might find in California are off limits here in Utah. So, but again, they are changing. They're adding some programs. The Utah Proud program has been a big help. And they will have some point of purchase stuff that we can put in some of the stores.
Now, are you allowed to sell your products from your location?
We have a Type 5 package agency,
which
is technically a tiny liquor store where we can sell just our products.
On what days of the week? Are you Sunday?
We're open because we don't have a restaurant on site, we can't be open Sundays. That's the legislation there. But we are open Thursday, Friday, and Saturday from 11 to 6.
Can you roll a hot dog cart into the parking lot and call it a restaurant and open on Sundays?
Well, since we're on this, where are you physically located? If people want to come by on Thursday or Friday?
We're over on Forestdale Drive across from the CrossFit gym.
Okay, so you can get a good workout in and then
grab a cold canned cocktail after your workout.
And let's segue into that. We've talked about gin, we've talked about vodka, we've talked about rum, but you also are moving into the canned drink area. Let's talk a little bit about that. What's the appeal of that industry to you, or that market segment?
It's a great way to give somebody a good cocktail they can take. Utah's an active state. Park City's very active part of that, and it's a cocktail you can take to a summer concert, you can take on the lake, you can take on the river, you can take on a hike. You're not bringing glass into those places. No one's mixing a cocktail there. A lot of people are moving away from beers, and so it gives another opportunity. And we went into it where we have had a lot of canned cocktails, but we always felt like there was something missing, and a freshness and a crispness that we weren't getting with those. And so we wanted to try our hand and see if we could do it different.
And tell us a little bit about the varieties that you've done so far, and maybe then we'll ask you, where do you want to go next? So let's start with what you got.
So currently we have the more bees with honey, keeping in the proverbial phrase branding. That is a bee's knees cocktail. So it's our gin. We use our own spirits. And so it's not a malt beveraged based drink like a hard seltzer. So that's gin, lemon, honey, and ginger. And that's it. Four ingredients, no preservatives. And it's shelf stable. We've cracked the science behind that. So we can have a shelf stable cocktail that tastes freshly shaken out of the bar. Normally, a drink like that wouldn't be carbonated if you ordered a bee's knees at a bar, but it adds a little freshness to it as well.
Especially because it's a little lower percentage than you would get at a bar. If you're getting at a bar, that's going to be about a 14% cocktail. Mm-hmm. But if you have, trust me, I know, if you have 12 ounces of 14%, it's bad news. And so we kind of worked them down to figure out what is, like, not sessionable, but what can you have two of before it's an issue. Because you don't want to overserve people, even though they're drinking out of a single serving can, you don't want it to be too much. And so, yeah.
That's really interesting that you have to conceive of it that way, right? That you're thinking about your customer, and you're thinking about, okay, what if they drank two of these? You say it's shelf-stable, and obviously you don't have years of experience. Do you have a sense of how long you think it might be okay?
Technically, it would be okay for forever.
Yeah.
But it's not going to last that long. If you buy one of these, you're gonna drink it
right away.
We have tested them for about 10 months.
Yeah.
Which is a realistic
that's fair.
Shelf life.
Yeah, honey lasts forever.
Okay, so that's your first canned product. What else is in the what else is in the back room?
So it's already developed, approved by the federal government, and we're just waiting on the can design for a gin and tonic. It's a grapefruit gin and tonic. It is light and refreshing, and we've added an extra carbonation, so it's a really bright tasting, great summertime drink or après-ski in the hot tub. Mm-hmm. We have a Mai Tai using our rum, and then a mule, which we hope both of those products we should have ready for the summer.
All three of those should be out by April, so giving us the four total.
Yeah. So again, are those in the development stage? Are those waiting for regulatory approval?
Those are waiting on printed cans.
So that's got to be fun too. This is radio, so we can't really do justice in how people understand what those cans look like. But tell us a little bit about the process of can development, illustration. How do you use that as a device to promote your product?
So the whole branding concept with Proverbial Spirits is that we're going to have fun with this.
We wouldn't have guessed that from our conversation. <this one. laughs>
We use bright colors. We use illustrations. When you walk into a liquor store, most branding is type-driven, black, white, silver, gold, leather-bound books. we are bright colors, pink, yellow, blue, And so our cans, you're going to, when the cans finally get to the liquor store, you're going to be able to find them no problem. We have, it's, we use the slim, tall format because it fits in your hand nicely. Mm-hmm. And it also creates a great space for branding. So when you see a bright yellow can with a 6-inch B staring you in the face, that's, you've found proverbials, more bees with honey cocktail. So it's been fun. We've been working with our partners, Zach and Dan, who do all of our branding, who we worked with in our previous jobs in advertising. They do all the logo design and the concepts and everything. We come up with the names. They do the visual part of it. And we're super excited about it because we, when they first came back to us with the first few drawings, we were like, nope, it's not bright enough. It's not fun enough.
Like, take all the parameters, all the lane guards that you normally have on for a normal brand, take them off. We want to be loud in your face and just, like, the most standout thing on the shelf.
Love it.
And just try to, you know, capture it visually. I always say you eat with your eyes first and your mouth second, so
yeah,
it's got to look good.
If you're listening right now and you want to see what we're talking about, if you go to Instagram at Proverbial Spirits, there's a beautiful shot of the can.
Nice. Now, real quick, we have a few seconds left.
Yep.
Are you green?
We are green. So we've been working with Recycle Utah to be greener, part of their green business program.
Nice.
We actually recently switched from plastic labels on our glass bottles to paper.
We also send all our stillage down to a digester down in Salt Lake City, which turns it all into methane. And then for our cans, we actually, instead of doing wraps, or paper labels on the cans, they're directly printed on the can, which allows us to do some really cool printing techniques you wouldn't be able to do otherwise. Textures, let the can show through, everything else, but also makes the entire can recyclable without any extra effort. You don't have to pull off the sleeve. You don't have to pull off the label. The whole can can just go in the recycling bin.
Awesome. That is great. Well, we just spent a few minutes speaking with Stephen Curry and Rudy Layfeld-Ellinger at Proverbial Spirits.
Our theme music was written by Parker Swenson and is performed by Swenson, David Becker, and Tony Ellison.
If you have any ideas for Mountain Money, please shoot us an email at mountainmoney@kpcw.org.
Please subscribe to the Mountain Money podcast to stay on top of all the latest episodes of KPCW's Mountain Money.
Thanks for listening. If you enjoy the show, make sure you leave a review no matter how you listen. And we'd appreciate it if you clicked 5 stars.